Paul is an anaesthetist in Brisbane. He started training in rescue as an ambulance paramedic in Tasmania before studying medicine in South Africa, where he spent 8 years in a mountain rescue team. Paul served on the Tasmanian Ambulance Service Medical Advisory Council and was director of the Advanced Airway Management Training Program and president of Royal Life Saving Society Tasmania Branch. Paul teaches search and rescue at the state and national level and is on the directing staff of the National Police Search and Rescue Managers course. He provides advice on survivability during SAR operations to AMSA, police search and rescue teams, and to the Australian Federal Police in PNG and the Solomon Islands. He's Medical Director, Medical Services Branch, St John's Ambulance Queensland, and has been invested as the Commander of the Order of St John. In 2006, Paul received the Australian National Search and Rescue Award, and in 2015, he was made a member of the Order of Australia for significant service to the community through emergency medicine. The title of Dr. Luckin's presentation is Timeframes for Survival, Medical Factors Affecting Survival in SAR Operations. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Paul Luckin.
Thank you, Martin. And firstly, I'd like to thank the organising committee for inviting me to come and address you. I recognise in the audience a lot of colleagues and friends from various organisations, AMSA, police around the nation. It's good to see you. I'm going to talk fairly briefly about timeframes for survival. Now, a timeframe for survival is an estimate of how long a missing person might survive in the prevailing conditions. In other words, to paraphrase it, how long you have to find a missing person while they're still alive. This has implications for the urgency of a search and rescue operation, and for the search and rescue organiser may dictate the type of search asset that they deploy, when they deploy them, or indeed whether there's any point in deploying any search asset at all. It'll give an indication of the type of location where a missing person is likely to be or where they're likely to be still alive, and hence where it's worth concentrating a search. It also gives information on the likely condition a missing person will be in. Is he able to assist himself or rescuers? Is he likely to be mobile or immobile? Is he likely to be hidden from view? Is it possible or probable that he's actively hiding from searchers? Now, we'll present it as a sort of static thing, but of course it's not. It's a complex and constantly evolving matrix. It depends not just on the search and rescue scenario, but lots of other factors. Medical conditions, things such as heart disease, diabetes, asthma, arthritis, medical conditions, whether the person is taking any medication at all, whether they're on drugs or alcohol. Dementia is becoming more and more common, and particularly in Queensland, we seem to have a lot of demented people walking away very frequently. Just a week ago, I looked through the 60-odd calls over the last 8 or 9 months, and about a third of them are demented patients who wander away from somewhere. History of the person is very important, and then the physical characteristics, age, sex, their height and weight. We'll look at some of those a bit later on, fitness or otherwise, whether the missing person is a swimmer, and their endurance. Clothing, whether they're wearing a PFD or not, the likely injuries they've sustained, vegetation, terrain, very importantly terrain and weather in terms of the availability of water, which is very often the limiting factor in survivability. Now the easiest way to go through these is to look at a couple of scenarios and go through those to demonstrate the relevance of some of the factors that I've mentioned. I think this is the 15th person, where are you, Mick? There. This is the 15th person to be swept off the rocks at Salmon Rocks in the last 10 years. And at weekends, I believe you've got people standing there lending them PFDs. They still get swept off and die. 172 centimetres, medium build. He'd been swept down the slope, sloping rocks into the water, about a 20-metre slide, rocks covered with barnacles. There's a reef nearby with a cave under the reef, which has previously served as a trap for people washed off. They get sucked underneath the reef and trapped underneath. Two and a half metre swell close to the rocks, but the current was drifting away from the rock, and offshore there was a 4 metre swell and 20 knot winds with white caps. And he was last seen 50 metres out, hadn't been seen since. Was he wearing a PFD? Please. Shorts, jumper, no footwear. He'd had a light lunch, nothing to drink. The estimated water temperature, 19 to 20 degrees. He was not a good swimmer, which is very common, unfortunately, in Asians. So now we were at plus 5 hours. What was the probability that he was alive at the time of the conversation? And what did we think would be the limit of survivability? So let's dissect that a little bit. What are the factors affecting his time frame for survival? Firstly, water at 19 to 20 degrees. Secondly, medium build. In other words, he didn't have a lot of body fat, so he didn't have a lot of thermal insulation. He was wearing minimal clothing, again, offering very little thermal insulation. His head was uncovered with 20-knot winds, and that implies that he would have been losing a lot of heat through his wet, uncovered head. Again, because he had little body fat, very little natural buoyancy, and no PFD, so he would have had to be swimming to stay on the surface and expending considerable effort. So he's at risk of becoming hypothermic, severely hypothermic, very quickly. Okay, water at 19 to 20 degrees. There's a thing called a thermoneutral environment. That's the temperature at which your body temperature stays the constant, which you can maintain body temperature without burning lots of excess energy. And in water, for human beings, that's about 34 degrees. On Sunday night, I was reading what's supposed to be an authoritative text that said if your body temperature, if the water temperature is 22 to 24 degrees, you can maintain your body temperature indefinitely. On Monday morning, my colleagues in West Australia phoned and said they had somebody, two guys overdue from a boat in water of 20, 22 degrees. Obviously, you cannot maintain your body temperature if you're in water that is below 34 degrees. You will lose heat. You must inevitably lose heat to the water because water has very high conductivity and very high thermal capacity. If the water is warm, 24, 26 degrees, you will still become hypothermic. It'll just take a little bit longer. So those of you in North Queensland, far North Queensland, please don't ever think that because the water's, by our standards, relatively warm, the missing person is not going to become hypothermic. Now, this is somebody who's demonstrating that a fairly high body fat content, try and say that, gives you lots of natural buoyancy, but it also gives you lots of thermal insulation. And our missing person of medium build had little fat, little insulation, and little clothing, all of which are against him. Now, when you start to cool down, your body's major physiological defense mechanism against becoming cold is peripheral vasoconstriction. The blood vessels throughout the body have tiny muscle fibers in the walls of the vessels. And when you become cold, those sympathetic muscle fibers constrict, close down the peripheral circulation, and shunt the blood into the core. That is to stop blood going out to the periphery in contact with cold water where it cools down. Now, the photograph on the left shows nice red hands. Red is nice and warm, going downscale to blue is peripherally shut down and cold. You can see the fellow on the left has nice red face, red forehead, red hands. And the photograph on the right, he's been in cold air, 12 degrees air, for about 45 minutes. And although it's only air, not water, you can see he's peripherally shut down. His fingers are not perfused at all. His nose is not perfused, but you see that his forehead is still nice and red. So that shows that he's vasoconstricting to maintain his core temperature. This infrared photograph shows the areas of maximum heat loss from the body. And you can see it's wherever there are large blood vessels close to the surface. So it's the sides of the neck, the groins, the armpits, and the lower abdomen, and of course, over the chest. So if you can protect those areas from heat loss, you can decrease heat loss very considerably. Now, the head on that would look like a glowing white ball because the face and head vessels do not have those little constrictor fibers. So when you get cold, everything else vasoconstricts, the vessels in the head and the face don't. And that's why when you get scalp wounds and head wounds, face wounds, they bleed like stink, bleed far more than wounds anywhere else do because those vessels don't close down. So this fellow floating with his head exposed and wet in 20-knot winds is going to lose a great deal of heat through his head, proportionally more than he will elsewhere. Now, the fourth thing we said was that he was having to swim to stay afloat. Now, that axis on the left, the vertical axis on the left, shows the rate at which your body core temperature drops. So the higher up the scale you go on the left, the faster your body core temperature drops. Across the bottom, the horizontal scale is time. That shows somebody jumping into cold water. And if you jump into cold water and stay still, what happens in the yellow line is that initially your core temperature starts to drop quite quickly, but then you vasoconstrict, and you level off at about 0.6 degrees drop per hour. So floating in, holding still, the yellow line in cold water, you would expect your core temperature to drop at about that rate. Obviously, it depends on the water temperature, but the point is that it levels off and you have a fairly low, constant drop in your body temperature. Now, the red line shows somebody who goes into the same water and is swimming to stay on the surface. And you see that his rate of heat loss climbs and only levels off at about 1.5 degrees centigrade per hour. So his body core temperature is dropping about 1.5 degrees. So the question is, when you are swimming to stay afloat, you're burning up energy, you're exercising, you're generating heat in the muscles, And people say, but surely that would keep you warmer. The answer is, as you can see from the graphs, no, because what you do is you send blood out to the periphery, you dilate your peripheral vessels, increase the blood flow to the muscle, and then, keeps on getting in my way, and then you keep on moving your limbs through cold water and you increase the heat loss. So the answer is you actually cool faster by swimming than you do by holding still. You can, of course, only hold still in the water if you have a flotation device. And this shows a thing called the UVic Thermofloat jacket, some of you will recall. He's in the HELP, heat escape lessening posture, that many of you will be familiar with. He's got his legs tucked up, so he's protecting the groins and the lower abdomen. He's got his arms against the side of the chest. He's protecting the inside of the elbows, the antecubital fossas, from heat loss. And normally he would put his hands over his neck to decrease heat loss from the carotid arteries and jugular veins, but that jacket actually has a big neoprene flap that seals the front of the throat to protect him. You can only do that, float in the HELP position, if you have positive buoyancy. So what of our lifesavers? They have a high muscle content, very low body fat content, they've got well-developed muscles, well-developed superficial veins, and they are swimmers and swim hard because that's what lifesavers do. So those guys are prime candidates for becoming hypothermic very quickly. And we always think of our very tough rescue and life-saving people as being immune from things like that. They are high-risk personnel. Okay, so when you become hypothermic, I've said that the peripheral vessels vasoconstrict. When that happens, they shunt blood from the periphery into the central circulation. So you increase your central circulating volume. Now, the kidneys interpret that as being a fluid overload, so they do what kidneys do, and that is they get rid of lots of urine. They prompt a diuresis. You've got hydrostatic pressure when you're floating in water. That also compresses the peripheral vessels and does the same thing. It pushes blood from the periphery into the central circulation. And again, your kidneys perceive that as an overload, so produce yet more urine. So you're becoming progressively more fluid depleted. If you swallow salt water, vomiting and diarrhea are fairly common and also increase the fluid loss. Plus the fact that somebody floating in water doesn't have a fluid intake, a non-salt water fluid intake, so they're increasing their fluid loss and progressively becoming more and more dehydrated, which gave him no buoyancy. But in fact, the jumper, a wet jumper, is something that causes a great deal of drag. And I'm sure many of you have tried to take off clothing in water, and particularly taking off a woolen jumper is very, very hard. It's exhausting. Doing that in a 4-meter swell with 20 knot winds and white caps slapping in your face, you're expending a huge amount of effort. You're swimming hard to stay on the surface. You're doing all of the things that we've spoken about. And all you need is to inhale a few drops of water for those to hit the vocal cords, and they can either cause bronchospasm, as in what happens to asthmatics, or spasm of the vocal cords, laryngeal spasm, where you can't get air in or out. You've all, when you've been eating or drinking something, had a drop of fluid or a crumb hit the vocal cords. And so he has a very high risk of aspiration and very high risk of death. Okay, so let's answer the question that the officer concerned asked me. What's the probability that he's alive now? Well, there's the trauma of entering the water. He's a non-swimmer. As we've said, little fat, no buoyancy, hypothermia, dehydration, exhaustion, aspiration. From experience as much as from anything else, I estimated that there was perhaps a 10% chance that he was alive at that time, the time of the request. But if he was, he would be so exhausted, dehydrated, hypothermic, that he would not be in a position to assist in his rescuers. So if he's close to shore, that means you have to physically drag him from the water. If he's a long way out and you can only reach him by aircraft and you can drop a raft, he's not going to be able to get into the raft. Okay, so the next question is, how long could he survive? Well, given it was late afternoon, I thought that the end of daylight, about plus 6 hours, was really the limit of his practical survivability. Now, let's assume I was wrong. I always say to the guys, phone me back in 10 hours and prove me wrong. I want you to prove me wrong and have a survivor. Of course, that's what we all want. But if he'd survived into the night, into the darkness, he's now lost the radiant warmth of the sun. He can't see the waves coming, so he's got waves slopping in his face because he can't turn against them, because he can't see them. And if you were to be alive and you were to find him, what is your chance of actually rescuing him alive in those conditions at night? 4 meter swell, 20 knot winds, and so on. So the SAMAC would then say, am I going to send rescue assets out? Is it justifiable to subject people to the risk? Fortunately, my advice will be the time frame for survival. I leave the impossible decision-making to the SAMAC. Okay, one other thing. When you've got a survivor in water, severely dehydrated, the hydrostatic pressure does something other than move the blood from the periphery into the central circulation. You normally have tone in the vessels in all of your body, but specific legs and in the abdominal vessels, and that keeps those vessels fairly small diameter. If you're floating in water, you've got the hydrostatic pressure pushing on the vessels, and after a little while, those vessels say, hey, you're pressing harder than I am. Why don't I just give up and let you do it? So those little muscle fibers relax. It makes no difference because the hydrostatic pressure is compressing the vessels. Then you come along and say, I'm going to rescue you and I'm going to pull you out of the water. Well, as you rescue somebody, or in fact as rescue is imminent, a number of things happen. First thing is that the person in the water sees you coming, sees the helicopter, sees the winchman, whatever it is, and he says, hallelujah, I'm going to survive this thing after all. And as soon as that happens, his noradrenaline and his adrenaline levels drop. The heart pumps more slowly and with less force. The blood pressure starts to drop. Then you lift him out of the water. And as you lift him out of the water, those vessels that have dilated no longer have the hydrostatic pressure, and the blood goes whoompa into the large vessels in the legs and what we call the venous pools in the abdomen, large vessels that dilate, and the blood pressure plummets. If you're lifting him vertically and the blood pressure to the head drops dramatically, he loses consciousness, and if you're unconscious in a vertical position, you obstruct your airway, and unless you sort that out very quickly, that means death. So, okay, let's look at the other extreme. Let's look at hot, arid environments, and we'll go to this type of bush. This isn't actually the area, but it's a type of bush near Ningen in New South Wales. I had to go back a little while to find one that suited my purposes. That was March of this year. At 18:44 in the afternoon, Brett Ferrari called me to say that the missing person, 25-year-old female, last seen at midday on Friday the 26th. So we were already a few days out. Now, a group of three of them had gone bush to go goat hunting. So the missing person had been with another male and another female. They'd had a flat tire, so they consumed some ice, as you do. Had an argument. The MP walked away. So the male drove off, went back to town, leaving the two females behind. He went to the pub and had a few drinks, as you do. The next day, he thought, might go back and look for the two missing people. And later, he reported to police that there were two missing females. Now, they were full of drugs. They obviously had drugs in the car. And apparently, goat hunting in that area is illegal, and they're on private property, hence the lack of urgency in contacting police. Terrain, low-level scrub, dry bush. It was not harsh. It was fairly easy to walk through, as you saw in that first photograph. She could have been able to find shade. There were no creeks, no rivers, so no water source, but there were a number of dams if you knew where to find them. She didn't know the area, and the police thought it unlikely she would know where they were and unlikely that she would find them by accident. So what were the effects of ice? Well, in the initial stages, probably confusion, quite possibly psychosis, where you're out of touch with reality, and that's one of the characteristics particularly of ice. So that means that in the initial period, the first day or so, while the drug was still having effect, she may very well have been totally irrational, and you would not expect that she had done anything in terms of procuring her own survival prospects. Was she avoiding police? Well, initially, quite likely she was, especially given her history, but that's an unknown. So severe dehydration and hypothermia are givens. That's inevitable. Let's just look at normal fluid balance. You normally take in about 1,400 mils a day in terms of liquid that you drink. The food that you eat contains about 1,200. Obviously, these numbers are broad approximations, broad averages. And as you metabolize food, you produce about 400 mils of water. So that gives you about 3 liters of water a day. And that's about 1.5 mils per kilogram per hour. And you lose, generally, urine about 1,700, sweat 600, lungs, in other words, through breathing, what's called insensible loss, about 500 mils, and you lose a couple of hundred mils in feces. And your urine production is about 1 mil per kilogram per hour. That's a level at which your kidneys are functioning. Below that, you start to get kidney problems. So when you're fluid deprived in a hot environment, your fluid intake goes to zero. Your food intake is zero, so your production from food goes to zero. So your total intake becomes zero or close to zero. Urine decreases very rapidly because you're not perfusing your kidneys very well. Because you're trying to sweat, you lose more in sweating, and you're breathing a hot, dry or hot, humid air. Either way, you increase the loss of fluid through the lungs, and within a day or so you stop producing feces and stop losing fluid through feces. But either way, you become very severely dehydrated very quickly. Now, the process of acclimatization to a hot environment is the process in which you learn to sweat a lot faster. Most of us can sweat at a fairly low rate. People who live in hot environments learn to sweat much larger volumes, and they can sweat up to a litre an hour. And it's with a lower salt content, but large volumes of fluid. So in this circumstance, somebody who's actually acclimatized to hot environments is at more risk of rapid dehydration than somebody who's not, because they have learnt to sweat larger volumes more quickly. So with not enough fluid to perfuse the kidneys, you enter a stage within a very short period of damage to kidneys and potentially kidney failure and even irreversible kidney failure. And once you become dry enough, then you can no longer sweat because you don't have the fluid to do so. And when you can't sweat, then you lose your ability to cool down. So what did we think of our missing girl? Her survival depends on water. Without water, you would expect that by halfway through day one, she'd be thirsty, still mobile, still thinking within the constraints of her drug habit, and able to assist searchers. She'd be able to signal, she'd be able to put some clothing on trees, she'd be able to put markers out on the sand, do the normal things to survive in an arid environment. By the morning of the second day, she'd be extremely fatigued, getting very weak, very limited mobility. And given that we're still talking temperatures in the high 30s, low 40s, no water, and she hadn't had a lot of water to drink before she left, and she's somebody with a low body mass, she's a thin, whippy, fit person, does not have a lot of fluid reserves to start with. By the afternoon of day two, I expected she'd be lying under some bushes, she'd be largely immobile, unable to assist searchers, with decreased level of consciousness, probably drifting in and out of consciousness, kidney failure, and hypothermic. And I did not expect that she would survive beyond the afternoon of day two, or at very best, perhaps into the night of day two, early day three. In other words, there's no point in searching areas where there is no water. The only prospect of finding her alive is if she is at water. So it would be reasonable at that stage for the SAMAC to say, we're only going to search where there's water, because if she's not water, she's not alive. I felt it very unlikely, given her history, that she had walked very far. I thought it was probably within 2 to 3 kilometres maximum, and I'd have been very surprised if it had been longer than that. Now, the idea of changing your search pattern according to where the person might be alive is one that we've exercised with great success in Queensland a number of times, with Jim Whitehead on quite a number of searches over the last couple of years, when we've had a discussion and I said, well, if the missing person is alive, they're in the following type of terrain, the following type of environment, they're doing this, they're doing that. Jim has halted a search, called in all the searchers, reprogrammed the search entirely, sent people out to specific areas, and we've had a lot of success with that. We've had quite a number of successes where we thought we were not going to find somebody alive. The outcome of that, on day 16, she was found deceased, and as we thought, she was 2.5 kilometres from the point last seen. She was lying under some bushes. She'd scraped a hollow, probably to try and cool herself down. She had no clothes on, which fits with the whole thing of psychosis, irrational behaviour, delusions, hypothermia, and the missing dog was lying beside her dead. I suspect that she died on the afternoon of day two from dehydration, but also the effects of hypothermia. Now, let's just put this into context. I said that the time frame for survival is a complex and evolving matrix with some of the things that we've looked at. But this melds into the SARMAC's evolving and very complex matrix himself. And the time frame for survival is one of the pieces of the jigsaw that he puts together. And he's got to look at all of the other things, the search assets that he has, the resources, the safety of the environment, the support services, very importantly still terrain and weather, and of course the external pressures of the family, the media, the politics. And on the basis of that, he uses the time frame for survival as one of the tools in making his risk-benefit assessment and deciding where to go from there. Thank you, Jim. That's not an uncommon scenario. Food is of secondary importance in the missing person, because most of us have fairly adequate reserves, as in we're fatter than we need to be, and we can survive by breaking down fat reserves. What happens if you're not taking in food is you change your metabolism. Instead of metabolizing the food that you eat, you start to break down your own fat and eventually your own muscle. So you get a change in how you metabolize things. And you can continue like that for quite an extended period. And people will often survive for 3 or 4 weeks without a food intake. So the problem is not so much not having the food. The problem is what happens when you find them and you start refeeding somebody who's been starved. If you've been starved for more than 5 or 6 days, then because you're breaking down fat and muscle rather than normal food, you become deficient in a number of things: phosphate, potassium, magnesium, and thiamine, one of the B12 group of vitamins in particular. So if you find the missing person and you produce your bag of jelly snakes or lollies or whatever, which is, you know, what people are inclined to do, you give them those, you give them a high glucose load. As soon as you give them the glucose, they produce lots of insulin. The insulin drives the glucose into the cells, and it drags with it potassium, phosphate, magnesium, thiamine. That drags behind, because of the osmotic gradient, drags behind it water. So you get swelling in the brain, you get swelling in nerve tissues. You suck potassium out of the serum into the cells, so you can get neurological damage or death very quickly. You can get sudden cardiac arrest from a sudden drop in potassium in the blood. So what you need to do is not give them carbohydrates, not give them things like glucose and so on. You need to give them vitamins, firstly. You need to give them phosphate, and you need to give them protein. So the ideal thing to give the person post-starvation is something like long-life milk, which you can actually leave out for the missing person, so if they find it first, because milk has very high phosphate and potassium content. Some multivitamin tablets, just some Centrum, and then the ideal stuff is some complex protein, just like some biltong or beef jerky, as we now call it, and we're going all American, and some biscuits. So that would be the thing, and leave small amounts, and you start feeding them fairly slowly. So going without food for an extended period is not usually the problem. The problem arrives when you refeed them. So when you refeed them, I'd suggest something like long-life milk and a multivitamin supplement to start with, and then something with protein and simple sort of ordinary biscuits.